Welcome to The Franchise. A podcast miniseries dedicated to your favorite movie franchises. This is The Franchise.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone is a 2001 British-American fantasy film directed by Chris Columbus. Based on the novel of the same name by J.K. Rowling, the story follows Harry Potter's first year at Hogwarts, his discovery of his wizard heritage, and the making of new friends Hermione and Ron Weasley. Production began in the United Kingdom in 2000. Chris Columbus had been chosen to direct the films amongst a short list of Steven Spielberg and Rob Reiner. It received positive reviews and went on to make over $970 million at the box office. It was nominated for the Academy Awards Best Original Score, Best Art Direction, and Best Costume Design. As of December 2015, it was the 30th highest-grossing film of all time and the second highest-grossing film in the series behind the final film, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 2. Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets was also directed by Chris Columbus and released on November 3rd, 2002. It follows the further adventures of Harry Potter and his friends during their second year at Hogwarts as they battle Voldemort yet again. It's the first time we meet Dobby the House Elf, Moaning Myrtle, and learn of Lord Voldemort's birth name, Tom Marvolo Riddle. The film opened to an $88.4 million opening weekend, making it the third largest opening of all time, behind Spider-Man and Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. It was also number one at the box office for two non-consecutive weekends. Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets was nominated for three BAFTA Awards and also later for six Saturn Awards in 2003 and 2004 for its DVD release. You're listening to The Franchise. In this episode, we will be discussing Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone and Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. My name is Razzle, and this is Kyle Newman.
Wow. Harry Potter. Everyone knows I'm a pretty big Star Wars fan, but I think second to that is my love of Harry Potter. So I am really, really excited to dive into this franchise of films. Joining us today, we've got an esteemed panel. As always, we have Jimmy Mack, our producer, and voice of reason sometimes coming from Chicago, our sound wizard over there. How's it going, Jimmy Mack? Are you ready to talk about Harry Potter?
Well, you know what, guys? This is pretty exciting for me. This is really exciting for me because typically when we do these episodes of the franchise, we all are kind of experts in our field when it comes to talking about whatever subject matter we're talking about. And here we are, Harry Potter. And I have to admit to everyone that I just recently saw all of the films. I binge-watched them because I did it for my brother, Kyle Newman. I promised him this year I would watch the Harry Potter films. And lo and behold, my days of being a muggle are long behind me. I know all about Gryffindor and Slytherin and Dumbledore and everything. But I've never read the books. Harry Potter was never part of my cultural fabric as a fanboy in any way, shape, or form. I'm known for Star Wars, talking Star Wars every week on Rebel Force Radio. So it's going to be kind of interesting for me to take a break from that to talk about Harry Potter. But even more interesting is the fact that I have never had a conversation about the Harry Potter films or books, the books which I have not read, but Harry Potter. I've never had a Harry Potter conversation with anyone in my life before. So this is new territory for me.
This is exciting.
Kyle, I know that your knowledge of this franchise is off the hook, and other people we're going to be talking to in upcoming episodes, their knowledge of it is going to be off the hook. So I hope I can just like represent the maybe more casual fan, the movie fan who went to see the Harry Potter films, and I will be asking the stupid questions, and I will be giving the stupid answers, and I hope that I can maybe represent that aspect of fandom. The fan that is familiar with the films, knows the characters, but it isn't part of a lifestyle thing. It wasn't part of their culture growing up. Again, like I said, I miss all of that. So that's good.
I think that's part of what we're going to talk about today is, you know, there is this legacy of the movies as books before they were, I mean, there were books before there were films. And that's part of our conversation. Did your boys, though, Jimmy, really quick, did your father and did your boys grow up with Potter? Did they read the books or were they into it at all? Or just wasn't in your household?
My kids, you know, they were, my oldest was born in 99. Obviously, he did go to elementary school, preschool, elementary school, all of that as the Harry Potter thing was hitting and happening. And I know he started to read the books. He may have made it through one or two of them. And I think he just sort of moved on. He never really got pulled in. Neither of my boys did. And as a matter of fact, nobody in my family had actually seen a Harry Potter film until I started watching them. And I binged watched them too. So apologies if I start getting confused with the films and everything, because to me, it's all just one big sprawling epic film. And I'm just really curious to see what really kind of that I took to heart, the things I really soaked in. And then I'm sure there's a lot of really important things that might've just gone right over my head. So I'm looking forward to building upon this newfound fandom I have for Harry Potter.
Great. Now, what we're going to do, the format of this season, so everyone knows right off the bat, is we are going to talk, we're going to have five episodes, and first two films in the series, Sorcerer's Apprentice and Chamber of Secrets, are what we're talking about today. And next episode will be Prisoner of Azkaban and Goblet of Fire. And our third episode will be Order of the Phoenix and Half-Blood Prince. And we'll finish that up with The Deathly Hallows, Part 1 and 2. And then we're going to all when you bring us more people and talk about Fantastic Beasts once we get to see that. Now, we're talking about Harry Potter films, too, today. And we do have somebody who was in a Harry Potter film.
Yes.
We have a familiar voice returning, Mr. Master Paul Bateman, Jedi Master Paul Bateman from England, originally from Nottingham, currently in London, production designer and film aficionado, Paul Bateman. Also, tell us about how you were in this, the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, I was in a bunch of them. I did four altogether. Athena did two. My Squeeze did the two of the ones that I missed. So we nearly had a full set, but not quite. But yeah, I like Jimmy, I was kind of like the books were not like on my radar when the first film was kind of going into production, and it was all kind of brand new to me, so I had no idea what to expect. But it was a really strange kind of experience kind of jumping into this kind of whole adventure without really being familiar with the books, when it seemed that every other person in England was really, really passionate about the books. So I actually read, you know, like I kind of dipped into them when I was on set, just because I was kind of curious to know more about what I was looking at and where I was and what was kind of happening, you know, just trying to kind of make sense of the things around me. So, yeah, definitely much more familiar with the movies than I am with the books. You know, I used to stick them on my earphones and listen to the Stephen Fry versions that are like about 24 hours long, I think, each one.
Yeah, but that's great. I experienced them that way too, Paul. I've read them. I've listened to the audio adaptations. And I've obviously seen the movies many times. And on a weekly basis, I go to the theme park here in Los Angeles to go to Wizarding World. Just sometimes go for 2 hours, get some
butterbeer.
Butterbeer
is so good.
And I bring my friend Georgie Flores, who is on tonight. And Georgie is a super geek. Georgie's
super
a big geek. Star Wars fan, a huge Harry Potter fan. And she's also an actress on a brand new series. You want to tell us about that, Georgie, and also about your Harry Potter love?
And Lord of the Rings.
Oh, and Lord of the Rings. Got to keep the Trinity.
Come on.
Oh, and I also called it Sorcerer's Apprentice before. It's Sorcerer's Stone. They should have stuck with Philosopher's Stone.
Yep.
And not switched it.
Yeah.
Sorcerer's Apprentice is a movie with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Talk about good movies.
Razzle
Paul, right?
Loves that.
Like, give
me some. Razzle's like, if I go to a desert island, leave 2001 behind and bring me some Sorcerer's Apprentice with Nick Cage.
Bring me some Face Off, man.
Oh, face yeah.
All the classics. Off.
So, Georgie, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Thanks, Kyle. This is my first podcast, so I'm really scared.
First podcast ever?
First podcast ever?
Podcast ever.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
Well, tell us about your love of Harry Potter, then tell us about your show. You got a new show premiering soon, right?
Yes, I have a new show. It comes out in April. It's called Famous in Love. And I play a version of myself, like a dorky theater nerd, so it's pretty cool.
And it's on ABC's Freeform, right?
ABC Family changed their name to Freeform, and that's yeah.
That's awesome. Congrats. And welcome to our franchise podcast. We're gonna get right into the Harry Potter conversation here. So we all know Harry Potter began as a series of books. Do you think the films have fully eclipsed the printed format, or have they truly embraced all that is wonderful about the book series? And even if you haven't read the books, everyone here knows the books were a big deal before they became a movie franchise.
Yeah.
And that's how people first discovered Harry Potter. It was the front page of USA Today every other week. It was like, Harry Potter storming the planet, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's, I probably got into it maybe the third book I got into it. And I'll be honest, I almost put it down until I got to page 80, because not much happens until, Hagrid shows up. At least it felt very one-dimensional to me. I don't know. This is my first impression.
Prisoner of Azkaban?
And then,
oh my God.
No, this is in Sorcerer's Stone.
I
didn't fall in love with it on first read. At first.
By the time I got to the end of the book.
I read it again. But it was a little slow to get going for me.
Yeah.
So what is your perception of it all? Paul, I mean, obviously this began in England. It was called The Philosopher's Stone first. What was the buzz over there before it became a movie franchise, and what do you think about how it's evolved, you being also on set for a lot of this stuff?
Well, it was strange. I mean, you know, I think I was the wrong age group, you know, in terms of kind of, you know, the kids that were really, really super passionate about it. You know, I wasn't really kind of part of that crowd, you know. It was the wrong kind of age range, you know, for me. Didn't know a lot of kids and stuff like that, but you kept hearing it on television. You know, we were talking about Harry Potter all the time. And then when we first got involved in the movies, you know, it was clear that every single kid that was on set had already read the book, and everybody was completely stoked to be a part of the movie, even though we had no idea how the film was going to turn out, you know. But we immediately understood that, you know, the word that was coming down from on high was it was going to be an exceptionally kind of English project, that they were looking to kind of like encapsulate a lot of stuff that people kind of think is cute about England, you know, like the whole look and vibe of various different kind of aspects of English culture. You know, they wanted to kind of keep that alive and make it very much a part of the movies, and they knew that was going to be a large part of its appeal, you know, internationally.
Yeah, very much down to the production design and the detail. I mean, you being on set, but I thought it's incredibly authentic. And I'm glad they stuck to those elements with the films and didn't try to, you know, soften it or just to homogenize it, make it like a global.
I mean,
feel.
Everybody did have pretty nice teeth, so that kind of took me out of the English plot setting. Jokes, guys. I gotta come in with the jokes. No, but I was reading on Wikipedia, and I definitely agree. Like, when they were doing the casting process and everything like that, J.K. Rowling was very adamant about having like an all English and all British cast. Like, she didn't want, she wanted it to be very centralized to like the book's setting and all that.
Because Tom Cruise would have been out of place. Now, Razzle's a big Tom Cruise fan. We had a little combo beforehand.
Yeah.
But this is
Tom Cruise
as
Snape would be the best movie ever.
This is an example of an actor that would have warped something that I think they did a very good job, you know, protecting the Englishness, the decidedly Englishness quality of this, the rainy streets, the little structures, like Diagon Alley. It's fantastic, but it also borrows so much from, you know, real places in London.
One of the things that was really kind of sweet about it, I mean, something that Phyllis should mention up front was, you know, I was lucky to be there for the very first day of shooting, and I was there for the very last day of shooting on the last movie.
Oh, cool.
So I kind of feel like, you know, I got to experience the whole kind of ride in a very kind of unique way. You know, it kind of felt like I've never been on a film set that felt quite so familial. You know, like, I mean, because these people worked with each other for 10 years solidly, and it wasn't like the Star Wars franchise where, you know, at least in the 70s and 80s, it was very spread out, and, you know, the crews would change quite a lot. You know, the very first day of shooting any of the Harry Potter movies, you know, with the exception, obviously, of some of the key players like the director and whatever, you know, generally, like, the crew was all familiar faces, and the very first day of any of the films was, like, kind of just picked up straight from the last one. You know, there was a real kind of comfort feeling as it went forward, and it was really sweet to sort of, like, see Daniel kind of, like, in his very kind of, you know, his first kind of, taking his first steps into the film industry, because he's surrounded by all this, you know, technical know-how and some of the, you know, the most skilled kind of craftsmen in the business over here, you know, that have been working for like 30 or 40 years already on films when the first Harry Potter movie went into production. And here's this little kid, Daniel, who's never been on a film set in his life, who was just so wide-eyed, you know. And Leesden was such a huge, huge place to be filming these movies. And it was initially when when they started on Harry Potter. It wasn't really kind of very, very well sorted out to be a production base. I mean, when you kind of got in there, it was just really just a big drafty aircraft hangar. I mean, because that's what it was for. It was built to make aeroplanes. So it wasn't really meant to be a film studio. And they'd only shot like, I think a Bond movie and Phantom Menace was shot there. But there was no soundproofing, so that it required a lot of ADR. There was just zero kind of like heating, and it was quite often filming through the winter. So these kids were all kind of, you know, freezing their ears off, you know. So it was a truly unique experience just because of where we were shooting it as well. But a lot of the locations that you see in the movie where you kind of think, well, that is just such a quintessentially kind of English location, were built from scratch. I mean, even Privet Drive and whatever was built right from the ground up, and it was, you know, you could just park your car on the street, you know, like inside the studio grounds. But it looks like a thousand, you know, housing estates. But they knew that right from the off that they were definitely going to make all of them, you know. It's,
wow.
So, yeah, you know, that's a good feeling, so going rad into it, knowing you're going to make 8 films, knowing you're adapting a true phenomenon. I don't think that worked with Mortal Instruments, but I don't think that was as much of a phenomenon. But, going into it, and then also with these kids, I mean, growing up on camera and the race to get them all captured on film in their teenage years, while you can't really make and release movies as fast as these kids are growing up. And that's something they did, you know, commendably throughout, you know, all 8 of these films. I'm sure Fantastic Beasts will have different challenges. So the role, I was going to ask Georgie, when did you first, did you read Harry Potter or did you just get into it as
films? I think second book, I remember I was at a book fair in school and finally, you know, one of my friends had.
How old are you?
I don't even remember. I don't remember. But it was the first like big book I read, you know, it was always like 30 page books, and then one of my friends was reading it. So when the second book came out, I was like, okay, fine, I'm going to go. I think I was like, so I got it at the book fair, and it was so good. And then I just couldn't wait. So every time each book came out, I forced my mom to take me to Barnes & Nobles. And
yeah, they had the big midnight openings.
Yeah. And my sisters were older, so they didn't care. But it was like the first book. I think what was cool about it is all these kids who, a lot of my friends never read a full, you know, book.
Yeah.
Then once those books came out, then we started reading more because we're like, oh my God, this is so fun. And it was just, it captured you from like the first, I think, 30 pages, you know, you were hooked.
Yeah, it's definitely the first book I didn't beat my brother up for reading.
Oh, see, I remember I was in Jamaica and with my wife, and I think Half-Blood Prince came out, and I was like, there's got to be, I got to get it here in Jamaica. And I was like, where's the bookstore? I want to find the, like, no, we don't have Harry Potter, man. And I'm like, what? And I was like stuck down there for a few days, but it wasn't a big deal there. I was like, it's got to be here. There's got to, where's anywhere, please.
I'll be honest.
And then I got to Miami Airport and it was like everywhere, like even like the bathroom, there was a guy in the bathroom selling Harry Potter books. Like, it was like, the book is here.
Yeah. I'm in Jimmy's sense where I didn't read the books, and I actually didn't finish watching the last 4 of these movies till prepping for the show. I've seen I watched the first 4 in theaters when they came out because all my friends were in on the hoopla, but I didn't read the books. It's hard for me to really read because my brain will like run and errands and wander. But it's definitely the first book series that I've ever remember having lines stretched around buildings to purchase books. It was almost as big of a phenomenon as the Star Wars prequels, buying tickets in advance when you had these people camping out to buy a book. Absolutely. Which is really absurd when you think about it, but it just goes to show how big of a fandom it had that people would camp out waiting for these new sequels.
I'm excited to expose it to I have a 3-year-old and a 16, nearly 16-month-old, and I'm reading them Fox on Socks on Blocks on Knox, you know, and I'm like, when do they get to read some Harry Potter here? Like, when's too early to start? I know the movies, he's gotten into the movies a little bit when I watch them. I take him to Wizarding World. He's got a wand, an interactive wand, and he's into chocolate frogs. But he can't go on the ride yet because they made the ride for like 6 feet tall people or bigger. It's like, I don't even, I'm almost 6'4", and I don't even know if I can go on the ride. Like, every ride at Universal is for like, you know, 40 or older. Mm-hmm. And so he can wander around Wizarding World, but he can only go eat chocolate or, get diabetes eating butterbeer. Yeah. There's nothing else for him to do. So it really didn't cater to kids with Wizarding World. Universal, get your shit together. Let's talk about the role of the author here. J.K. Rowling's influence as a visionary world creator. And I think it's akin to, you know, Walt Disney or George Lucas and, you know, Jimmy and Paul, you guys being Lucasites and Star Wars historians. What do you guys think about the rare influence of the creator on a film series? And obviously, she didn't direct these movies, and George didn't direct all of the Star Wars films, nor did he write them all. She didn't adapt all these screenplays. She wrote the core stories, and then other people brought them to life. So there's a lot of similarities, but do you think she's on par with George Lucas as a creator and also culturally?
Wow, that's a really strong thing to consider when you think about all the decades that we've been, you know, consuming Star Wars and other things that George Lucas has spun off. I would say no at this point.
She didn't rape anyone's childhood yet, right? Not that I've heard, based on what you hear about George Lucas. So I was like, George Lucas raped my childhood. You know, I haven't heard those complaints about J.K. Rowling yet. Maybe with Fantastic Beasts, we'll hear that.
You know, well, it depends. No. See, that's the thing, though, is how many different times can she roll the dice and come up a winner? Now, Lucas did so with Star Wars, and he did so with Indiana Jones, and he did so with American Graffiti, for crying out loud. So, I mean, those are three big home runs for Lucas, and thus is really establishing himself as more than just a one-trick pony.
Different characters, different worlds,
perhaps,
yes.
J.K. bring something else to the table. I find it interesting, too, because in my limited research, I did do very limited research for this. I saw the films, and that's about it. I binged the films, but I did today go on the Pottermore website for the very first time, and I did look at Harry Potter Wikipedia stuff just to kind of get, you know, some of these character names figured out and whatnot.
Wait, what house did you get sorted into?
Did you get sorted?
Did I get sorted? With the hat.
You have to.
I would probably be Slytherin all the way. But
Slytherin.
But what's interesting is that in my limited research, I did discover that Rowling was very much a player on the set during the shooting of this film. Her influence was constantly being felt. And so I don't really know much else beyond that. Like, did she actually get into it with the filmmakers themselves? Was there any sort of friction there? Was she being demanding, or was it a fairly peaceful operation all the way through? Paul says the set felt like a big family. So I think that everything in the process went relatively smoothly, and maybe Paul can shine some light on that too. But I don't know. It just seems like for someone whose book is being made into a film, it seemed like she was hands-on much more than any author that I'm aware of.
Yeah, you don't see that with Divergent or Hunger Games. I think they defaulted to her a lot. She had a lot of say, I believe, in picking Columbus as a director and where this series ended up in terms of who was making it and how it was being made. And so she retained that kind of distant authorship, so there was the need to be reverent to her. And I think
rare.
It's almost independent because, Jimmy, you're talking about Pottermore, but George Lucas, you know, being a super independent guy, and he made his films independently. These were made by, obviously, Warner Brothers and a big studio.
Right.
But things like Pottermore, she carved out all of these ancillary type of elements, which allowed her now to expand the franchise, her world, beyond just these eight films. Now it's the Wizarding World. So you go to the park, it's not the Harry Potter park, it's the Wizarding World park.
Oh.
So she's set it up to go back to the 1920s in the new film for Fantastic Beasts. So it's a prequel. And again, they're going prequel, you know, for the next series of films.
Fantastic Beasts?
Was like a smaller book that they put out in between the novels, which was just like a kind of a creature compendium.
It was describing creatures
kind of in an in-universe way, and Newt Scamander was in it as like a beast kind of, a cryptozoologist, I guess, because they're all fantastic monsters.
The book came out in 2001 for Fantastic Beasts, and it was written by J.K. Rowling.
And it's short. It's what, like 50, 60 pages?
128 pages.
128 pages, yeah. Wow. Okay, there was the other book. She's done a couple. There was another book that came out, Beetlebard.
Now,
And the movie was written, apparently, according to the website, Fantastic Beasts, the movie was written by J.K. Rowling.
Oh, rad.
Yeah.
I think the only one that wasn't, the only movie that wasn't written, though, by Stephen Cloves was it Order of the Phoenix?
Was it written by Stephen Cloves?
No, like he adapted all of them. So they found a way from the books to the films to give us a congruent, consistent voice by sticking with the same screenwriter also the last four films, which I think, you know, the films kind of grow in maturity with David Yates, who's doing a Fantastic Beasts. Mm-hmm. Now, do you think the films have evolved with the audience? Now, Jimmy, you're watching these for the first time, and the immediate perception is they're kids' movies. Like, I'm watching The Sorcerer's Stone and Chamber of Secrets, and there's 10 and 11-year-olds, kind of like Jake Lloyd and Phantom Menace as your protagonists. Only there's no Qui-Gons, really. You know, it's kids. And was that like a deterrent? And then finally seeing this, did you find, like, by the time you got to the seventh and eighth films, were you looking at them differently, or did you still look at it as a franchise that was, you know, more youthful?
Well, it was interesting to note the evolution and the age and the growth of all the, especially the younger actors, you know, sort of like watching that movie Boyhood, where you would see the same actor grow up. And to me, I was like, oh, that kid looks a little different than I thought he would. But for the most part, I thought they all aged pretty well, despite going through some of those really awkward teenage years. I think they all aged pretty well. And it was fun to watch. And like Boyhood, just while I'm thinking of this, there's a scene in Boyhood. And you know how Boyhood rolls. It's just sort of like just a bunch of memories all tacked together to sort of represent this guy's life as he's growing up. It was shot over the course of a decade. Same actor. You see a kid from, you know, grow up as, I think, from like elementary school all the way through college or to, you know, his freshman year in college. So you watch this kid grow up. And that's similar to the Potter films. And in Boyhood, there is a scene where he's dressed up as a wizard and he goes out with his family to get that Harry Potter book at midnight. And he's walking and he's, you know, and to me, it almost chokes me up thinking about it, because the guy is just, it has nothing to do with the movie, but it was just like, the movie is made up of all of those memories that impact you and make you grow as a person. And I just thought it was so sweet that he was remembering going to get that Harry Potter book. Wasn't referred to before or after in the film, but there it is, representing just a huge moment in this kid's life. And so it's so nice when you're able to connect with your favorite story or whatever. When you make that connection as a fan, I think there's something really special about it. But, you know, back to watching the kids grow up, obviously the film series just gets darker and darker the older they get, which is a relief to me, because if it came out of the gate being really dark and they're all like 11 and 12 year olds, I'd be maybe a little upset about it. But I was fully able to deal with it by the time the you-know-what started hitting the fan, because I had the confidence in the characters. I felt like the characters had grown enough to where they were able to take these challenges on head-on. So when you see a kid getting tortured, or even, as the case may be, in these films, you see kids getting killed, it's easier for me to handle as it happens later, as opposed to it being dark right out of the gate. So I love the way the series evolves. And it just keeps going down that vortex, and the challenges and the dangers and the absolute danger becomes so clear by the end that I think as an audience member, I'm ready to handle it along with the characters. So it's really interesting to watch this all evolve. A question I have for you, Kyle, because you're a total expert, is is this supposed to happen? Now, you mentioned the new film is set in the 20s. So when is this happening? When is Harry going to school, if we're looking at a real calendar?
Well, it's not current day. I mean, I think even cell phones weren't is it the late 80s or early 90s, something like that? Or is it the 90s? Right. It's the 90s, I believe.
Mid-90s, yeah.
Mid-90s, and it goes along with it, because cell phones weren't really a part of it. So it is in a sense a period thing.
Yeah.
Fantastic Beasts takes place in 1926.
And the Harry Potter films, when the first one, is it set in like 1996?
That would seem right, because that's when she was writing the first book, wasn't it? During the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she wrote a lot of these out of her home or in a little coffee shop up in Scotland. And you can feel the influence of what she's writing, coming through in it all. Here's a question. For me, like, this is something I fully haven't wrapped my head around, and maybe, you guys have different interpretations, but there's a key scene early on in Sorcerer's Stone with the snake at the zoo, and Harry makes the glass disappear without wand or the knowledge of magic. He's not even really indoctrinated into it or aware of this world of magic and wizards, but he does so as if it's an innate ability. What do you think this means? What does it mean to be a wizard in this world, and what does the wizard bloodline really offer versus being a muggle? Like, are magical powers and the way they're portrayed consistent throughout the franchise? Because here we are in a very early scene, and Dudley's been difficult with him, and he's pressed against the glass, and poof, the glass disappears. The snake comes out. It's our first introduction to Parseltongue, and Harry's kind of fused legacy with snakes and Slytherin and Voldemort. Like I said, there's no wand here, and does that stick out when you go back and watch all the films as to how he's doing stuff like this without knowledge of it? It's almost like he's tapping into the Force. Mm-hmm. Is that weird to you guys? I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, because I don't know if it's ever been, and I'm forgetting how they explained it in the book, because I have not gone back to read the book in quite a little bit of time.
Well, it's kind of similar to that flashback they have in the later film where they show young Snape with young Lily Potter. And it seems like she has these skills, she's learning how to use the magic, and it's just kind of coming to her naturally. And it sort of manifests itself in weird ways. And that's what was happening with Harry. He didn't even know what he was doing, but it was just the nature.
So it's more about the bloodline.
I think
that you're innately a wizard. That's what makes you different from there's magic to magic potential, mudblood versus pureborn.
I mean, frankly, also, if you got like a 10-year-old, however old he is, and a snake starts talking to you for the first time, you're not going to be cool with it. You're going to be kind of surprised and shocked. You're going to be kind of like, what's going on here? Let alone glass disappearing. Mm-hmm. However, there was a bit of dialogue, now that I'm thinking about it, because I was originally going to debunk it and be like, oh, well, this doesn't make any damn sense. But isn't there a line where that shitty uncle is like, and no funny business or whatever, mm-hmm. almost implying that Harry has somehow accidentally caused magic things to happen and caused trouble before?
He has, and didn't a bunch of things happen?
But is that something that all these kids can do, or is this intrinsic?
No, I think all the kids can do.
To Harry being the chosen one.
That's why they're accepted at Hogwarts, maybe, because they accidentally make.
But you said the scene with Lily and with Snape, and they're, by that point, they're already at school. They're students. They're aware of their abilities, and they've tapped into it. So I guess it's an innate thing. I mean, it's something that doesn't really get explored again in the subsequent movies, because we're in the wizarding world, and then there's a world of people without magic.
Well, I think most kids grow up knowing that they are magic, right? Because they have wizard parents. So,
but then you have the girls, like Hermione is.
Oh yeah.
Is not.
Well, maybe
that descent.
And like he just thought he was a weird kid, so maybe he knew that he had like weird things happen to him. So I think it was just about intention. Like he was like, oh, I really like I'm so mad at Dudley, and then he's not aware of his own power, and then that, it's the power of their mind.
Here's something then. What about, so Hermione is a normal girl, right? Mm-hmm. Her parents are normal human beings.
Yep.
And she's all of a sudden got these witch powers. A, how did they not just burn her right away? Or B, how did, like, if Hogwarts is such a secret, like the whole idea of magic being not real and a secret society, how do her parents figure out about Hogwarts to enroll her or submit
her?
Her
a
it was
letter.
Before social media, dude.
They send her a letter and they're like, this is why your kid is like this. We have a school for kids like this.
But if you don't know about it, wouldn't you think you're being like punked?
Yeah.
No, they know that their kid is doing weird cool stuff, and then they're like, oh, this is it.
It's like Xavier's School for Mutants. It's like when the Jedi come to take your child because they demonstrate strange abilities.
Yeah.
I get it.
She just had good parents who embraced it and then were like, yes.
Luke Skywalker, very similar to Harry Potter. I mean, he grew up with innate abilities. He didn't know them. He couldn't put his finger on what they were. He had people shielding him from knowing about the greater truth to who he was, an aunt and an uncle. There are a lot of similarities with, obviously, Star Wars being the most famous modern myth. Paul, does this franchise borrow elements from other myths, modern tales? And I'm talking about Star Wars, but you have things like the prophecy, a chosen one. That's something else that's big in Star Wars, but it's big in all types of mythology. Is it almost like just accepted that you have to go back to Joseph Campbell and you have to borrow from these classic things? What do you think? I mean, obviously, just a few examples right there. I mean, it's so tangibly Star Wars.
I mean, I kind of feel as though, I mean, to flashback slightly to what you were, you know, your questions about JK, you know, I kind of feel as though she most definitely was kind of drawing upon the whole kind of hero's journey thing very consciously. And you can tell that she was pulling from everywhere and had the smarts to understand that was a good idea, you know, based upon things like Star Wars and other success stories that have used that kind of a model. So I think Harry Potter's full of those kind of things. And it, to me, it always feels like it's the second most successful attempt at kind of adapting kind of Campbell's teachings into a movie in a quite kind of direct way. I mean, you know, there are websites out there, aren't there, that kind of just compare Star Wars and Harry Potter quite literally, you know, and you can almost tell the entire story from start to finish and not tell which story they're talking about if you just kind of, you know, say kind of like an orphaned kid, you know, and
even Voldemort's his identity as a villain is so fused to Harry Potter's.
Voldemort to Star Wars or
Voldemort to Harry Potter, and the way like Luke and Vader, there's these discoveries to it. Not that they're related, but that they're you're an obstacle in my way to do my plan. Voldemort, and there's pieces of like him in Harry Potter. There's his wand. They almost have like brother sibling wands, and that's a big thing they set up in this first film when he goes to get his wand. Mm-hmm. He lets him know that the only other person that hasn't that same element is he who shall not be named, and that's a big part of Deathly Hallows.
Yeah, especially that scene in this Sorcerer's Stone it mirrors the scene in Star Wars A New Hope where Darth Vader was hiding on the side of a dude's head.
What?
I'm kidding.
You're asking about whether or not JK was present and stuff like that, and I think JK was much more present during pre-production, and on the actual set she very rarely kind of came in when they were actually shooting. She'd be there occasionally for, you know, scenes that were important to her and what have you, but generally she was quite hands off, you know. She sort of but whenever she did come in, you could tell that, you know, having been on numerous sets where the writers do turn up. I mean, I remember working on the Golden Compass when Pullman showed up, and you know, people barely knew who he was, and working on The Colour of Magic when Pratchett turned up, and people were just kind of, you know, gently acknowledging him. But when JK showed up on Harry Potter, everybody, you know, knew who she was. Everybody treated her with respect. So she obviously was an enormous deal to everybody on the production, and it was a very unusual setup. You could tell that people, you know, acknowledged that she was calling the shots on some very significant level. But for me, I think what seemed to be more important to JK than the hero's journey and all those aspects that I think were probably important to her when she was writing the book, but not, you know, that work had kind of been done by the time the movies were kind of going into production. So I think her focus became more about culture. You know, I mean, I remember, I know Carl, we've talked about this before, in that I think that you know, For British people, like, witchcraft is a very kind of different thing to, you know, the kind of general, you know, kind of way that people sort of perceive it outside of Europe. You know, in the witchcraft is almost like kind of, it's in our history. You know, we all as school kids, you know, we went to places like Pendle and we'd see places where we knew there were witch trials and stuff like that. And it's a very kind of, it's almost orthodoxy. You know, we were a pagan community right up until the invasions of the Normans and stuff like that. So we're very much a kind of aware of her own kind of tree-hugging past, you know. And so I think for her, I think what she was trying to do was kind of like encapsulate that kind of like ancient British kind of feel, you know. And I think that's where she's pulling from as much as anything. She's pulling from kind of, you know, like mythologies for sure, but she's also just kind of like, I think she's just nodding to a lot of different aspects of British culture. So I think when she was on set, that's what she was really bothered about. She was like, okay, this bookshop needs to feel like all these kind of curiosity bookshops that we get in Wales, you know. And she wanted, you know, certain things to look exactly like, you know, her kind of what she was picturing. So I think when it came to the movies, she was all about how it looked rather than the subtext and the story. I think she kind of felt like she'd already kind of made sure that the script was okay. And so when it came
she
to
helped
the shoot,
cast, I mean, she had a say in who these kids were going to be. And like, there's something, yeah. the buildings are just a little crooked, or there's a forced perspective. It's mildly reminiscent of like what Tim Burton was doing, production design. And I think there's this beautiful fusion of the real world and organic, but then letting the wizard world just be a little off. Like, physics doesn't apply to everything you're seeing. There's a magical element maybe to construction. I mean, just take, for one example, we don't see it in the first film, but take, you know, Ron's house and the Weasley's homestead and this almost tall, lopsided building. You get a much better sense of it as the movies go on until it sadly burns down in Half-Blood Prince, oh, sad. But that was, you know, just these really unique structures, Gringotts, all the storefronts. And, it feels like you're wandering around London, but everything's so heightened and pushed. So I can imagine her walking onto the set and seeing this production design and being like, all right, we're good.
The most beautiful set I've ever been on in my life, and I've been on a lot, was definitely Diagon Alley. I think it just had a richness to it that you can't imagine. I mean, like, I've seen the recreation, because when Leavesden was bought out by Warners after they finished the Harry Potter movies and they built the visitor center and what have you, it'd be easy to assume that what you're getting in there is just a straightforward kind of representation of what was, you know, what we saw on set. But it actually changed quite a bit. You know, they opened up a little, you know, Diagon Alley, so it's more kind of you know, visitor friendly, but the actual set itself felt much more kind of unstable, much crookeder, and the actual interiors of the shops were quite amazing in terms of, a lot of them had windows that had special glass in, so you got that kind of, it had like an amplifying effect, so when you look through the window it looked enormous, and then if you open the door and went in, all of a sudden it's a much smaller kind of environment than you realize. And the actual bookshop, when you walked just inside the door, there's, you know, full-size books on the windowsill, but you go back 10 foot and the whole set is false perspective. So at the very back of the shop, you've got these tiny little steps with tiny little books on them, you know. So they really made the most of the environment. I mean, it was a huge environment as it was, but then they did all this extra stuff to kind of, like, you know, convince you that it was even deeper and even bigger. And if you look really closely at a lot of the set dressing, it's quite incredible what they did, because they did things like, they wouldn't just paint a shop sign. They'd paint a sign, then they'd sand it off, and then they'd paint another sign, like somebody had, you know, bought the place and it now had new owners.
Renamed it.
No way.
It gives it the layers of history.
Yeah, they really put the history into it, you know. And I think if you spent enough time on that set, it was so hard not to be just totally blown away.
That's why people want to keep going back to this world. That's why people want to go back to the books. They're so immersive. That's why people want to go visit the theme park.
Yeah.
That's why people are excited about it. That's the same thing that, you know, Star Wars has these layers to it. Harry Potter obviously has these layers. That's one of the elements of success. You know, in a story sense, you have the sorting hat. You know, it's very conflicted when it's placed upon Harry's head, but it ultimately places him in Gryffindor, even though it debated Slytherin. What do you think its purpose for putting him in Gryffindor was, and by doing so, what are the challenges Harry faces? I mean, it's probably very purposeful, but what do you think, Georgie? By sticking, like, him in Gryffindor over Slytherin,
I think that Slytherin came from his tie with Voldemort, but he was really just a Gryffindor. So the Sorting Hat considered Slytherin, and then Harry was like, no, and they let's, you know.
Do you think it's like that? It knew that, you know, Harry Potter's strength comes from friends, and he was going to. Is it about who you're with or how you're placed? Or because here's another big question for me. I think it's a question for you guys. Do you think that Harry Potter has it easy in these films? Is there too much help from outside people, or is that precisely the point? Let's look.
No, he okay. couldn't have done it without a.
There's
it, without
Fox.
His
he gets Godric Gryffindor's sword. Like that's what I mean. He couldn't do
he has
any
Ron
of this.
And Hermione.
And is that part of the reason he's placed into Gryffindor by placing him? Is it like a fateful thing, knowing he's going to need friends and that love and friendship are going to be the things that are going to help him do what he needs to do? Or is that by chance that it's...
No, he couldn't have
done
it.
So you think Sorting Hat is almost...
I think the
precognitive in that way. Yes. He knows...
The Sorting Hat, because the Hermione and Ron and Harry, they all have different strengths. It's like when you, you know, it's like a heist movie where they're like, we need the tech guy. We need the, the muscle. We need the master of disguise. And the Sorting Hat knew that if he put each of them individually in the houses that they should go to, you know, the Hufflepuff or Gryffindor or Slytherin, like their, if the Sorting Hat just took their characteristics and put them in their, the house that is synonymous with those characteristics, they wouldn't grow as individuals or friends. So he took a Slytherin, and instead of putting Harry with a Slytherin, which he should have been, he put them in with Ron, who should have been somewhere else, and Hermione, who should have been somewhere else, because together they latched on each other's strengths and weaknesses and helped them better off as children, as a school.
She keeps exploring that too in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. With Harry Potter's son, she places it, how she places him, why she places him. It's a challenge then that ultimately it wouldn't have happened. Things wouldn't have gotten resolved the way they would have, and history wouldn't unfold the way it's going to unless he's placed the way it does, and it challenges him in a certain way. And part of it is that's the story. You need story to have conflict, or else it doesn't propel forward. But part of it is, you know, fate and design. Here's another big element here. The Dursleys. Do you think they evolved well throughout these films or overall and through these first two films? What do you think? Are they so one-note? Like, for me, they've always been a bit one-note, but I do think they ended up evolving to a point where I really understood and liked them more. But what do you think about the Dursleys? Anybody out there want to challenge them?
I don't know. I didn't take note of any evolution there, and I was constantly scratching my head as to why Harry continues to return to their care.
Me, too.
I mean, it just
he's protected there at their house.
He didn't know that, though.
Isn't he protected at their house until a certain age?
He didn't know that until later.
He didn't know that, but the Dursleys, obviously, it's his mother's sister.
Yeah.
There's this familial thing there.
The Dursleys knew, and I didn't think he had anywhere else to go, though.
But I think there's a protection on the house, so he's safe there from anyone getting to him.
But Jimmy, you're saying why would he keep going back?
Well, I, you know what?
If they're so mean.
I enjoyed it because to me it was one of those essential elements, much like how at the beginning of a Bond film, he always walks into Q's office and gets his balls busted. You know, I mean, it's one of those things that just keeps recurring throughout the series. And so when each film or not each film, but when most of the films opened up with those sequences with Harry going back and forth with those jerk bags, it was always just like really, it was almost like comfort food to me. I'm like, okay, here we go. Here's another Harry Potter film. Let's get it rolling. It's, you know, then, beginning with the traditional staples of the film. And there are a few others throughout, but that's a big one. And also I consider, you know, when they gather together in that big dining hall at the school, that's another one of those staples where it just is like, okay, this is a Harry Potter film.
They're particularly cruel, almost like, you know, Cinderella's.
Yeah. I think that's what was great about it, though, is like he had such a contrast between like being at school and where he belonged and then being like an outcast. That
he doesn't belong in this world,
and
he's
exciting,
out of place with his identity.
Yeah.
It is a great contrast, and he gets this warmth there. Now here's another thing. These films are all there's always a mystery element to these movies. Sorcerer's Stone, it's a big part of it. All the emphasis is on Snape, but it's really somebody else. Chamber of Secrets is probably the most whodunit of the series. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's why I'm just thinking this now. Maybe it's why people consider it the weakest of the eight films. It's probably the most faithful to the book adaptation of
but
it's also the longest film. I think it's over 160 minutes, and they tried to get every element of the book in there. But it is the most, as Razzle put it, Hardy Boys.
Yeah, it's very procedural in the sense that it's got the same beats as a Hardy Boys book, mm-hmm. or if you remember Georgie before her time, there was the Hardy Boys show that on the Wonderful World of Disney or whatever, where you have you get the first plot points, you get seeds of what the mystery is going to be and what's happening, then you get taken in a different direction, and then you're much like procedurals on TV, you get the option and the thought that someone is bad like Snape, but they end up turning to be a red herring or something, yeah. Where it's not the right direction. It leads you to think they're going to be the bad guy multiple times. And even stepping back and looking at the series as a whole, they continue to beat that Snape's the bad guy, but he ends up being good guy the whole time.
But they do go somewhere with it, which is
But they do finally go somewhere with it. Whereas
was that always her plan?
Say that again?
Do you think that was always her plan?
I don't think so. I think it was like the George Lucas plan.
Or is that like
I think they say it's a plan, but I will say though, the whole snake thing, I think, could have been a major plan. Because from the get-go, he can talk to snakes, and then all of a sudden snakes come back later
on. Snape being so close to Snake. I think she set up a lot of things in the wordplay. Obviously, Snape and Quirrell in this first film. And then in the second film, it's Gilderoy Lockhart, and again, there's emphasis on Snape and where this artifact or this old diary came from. Ultimately, being a Horcrux, mm-hmm. even the idea of Horcruxes. Do you guys, Jimmy, having watched all these films together now, it builds up to this pinnacle where it's all about collecting the Horcruxes, which are fragments of his soul, and destroying them.
Yes.
And do you feel like that was, again, an afterthought, or do you think that was something? Me, I think it's a little bit afterthought because it all got jammed into one book, mm-hmm. but I read it as books. Do you, watching it as films, feel like it was an organic build, an evolution, or did it come later? It's like, oh, we need a conflict for book 7 or films 7 and 8. What is it going to be?
Well, one thing I like about this series is how things gradually get revealed, and you learn through the character's experience. You're never like several steps ahead of the characters. You're with them along the journey. And so they're finding things and you're like, what the hell is that? And then there's no explanation for it. Well, obviously, because the characters themselves have no explanation for mm-hmm. it. So Harry finally, gets the knowledge of this physical representation of Voldemort's soul or his evil or whatever it is. And it has to destroy it. So it makes me think of instantly Lord of the Rings, of course. You destroy the power, destroy the ring. And that's kind of the vibe I was getting from it all along. So it almost felt a little derivative. And, it's what you call the MacGuffin, of course. They're going after these things. You care about the characters, but you don't really care what they're chasing. You just want to see them succeed. So that's just, it just felt more like a device. And, I have to admit that the first part of Deathly Hallows, it seemed like in the middle there was really dragging to me. And I wish it would have just gotten along with it. And I kept thinking to myself, well, wouldn't this be interesting if it was one movie instead of two parts?
But there's a lot of ground to cover. Yeah, that was the thing. When I first read the book,
I was thinking
it was taking
a
long time to collect.
Moving from place to place and looking for clues.
And Horcruxes, like I said, they are in the movies earlier, but we don't know what that is.
Right.
But we do see this with this diary. And then when he stabs the tooth through it and he destroys the diary, he's killed part of Tom Riddle, Voldemort's soul, one of the fragments. And I just don't know if that was like hindsight appropriating it. Oh, that there's a Horcrux. There's one off the list.
Can Harry himself be considered a Horcrux? Because he had that part of Voldemort in him. And
he
had to die, essentially, to defeat the Dark Lord.
Yeah, he was
a Horcrux. Part of him, when he did that thing, part of him was placed in Harry Potter.
So what do you think? I mean, is he a Horcrux himself?
He is a Horcrux.
Yeah.
I thought that was...
What do you think, Paul?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I kind of... I've never really looked at it that way. I think... What did just occur to me then when you were talking about, the feeling of certain books kind of dragging and stuff, something I feel I should mention is I think that the the directors made a big difference to how this material felt as you went along. And I kind of feel like I can't really speak to, you know, whether or not a book dragged or a book, you know, maybe you kind of like overlaid a point or kind of like squeezed a point in. But I kind of feel as though like Chris Columbus's approach to, you know, to the whole kind of thing felt very kind of almost kind of like very minimalist and very kind of like, let's speed things along. But then
it was safe. Yeah, you know what I mean? Because then, also you're launching a big franchise.
Yeah. But then David Heyman was just, he was a total breath of fresh air. He was a lovely, lovely guy. And you could tell that he was one of those guys where, he was one of those guys where you kind of like feel like he's so attentive to absolutely every single detail. And it turned out that he started out as a journalist. And so he was one of these kind of people that I think he was really kind of meticulous about everything and he wanted to get his hands on everything. So I think something was kind of like very mildly developed, I felt as though he was the kind of director who was going to just really kind of belabor a thing almost, but in a good way. You know, he's really kind of like keen to explore every single detail. So it didn't surprise me at all that, you know, one book turned into two and you know.
I look at what David Yates did later on. It's kind of like when Irvin Kershner stepped into Empire Strikes Back. He took what had been established and he elevated it. Like Half-Blood Prince, you know, looking back is probably the finest achievement of them all and the hardest to actually direct because of the unique, it's the funniest of the movies. It's also almost the darkest. It's almost like The Empire Strikes Back with like the death of Dumbledore and what happens with Snape and all these dark revelations. But it's also the warmest. It's probably the kids are at their finest in terms of acting, like the details and nuance and the flirtation and the hormones, but also the comedy. And it's interesting to see that evolve from where Columbus started. And I think the challenge with him was he probably had a studio breathing down his neck. There's a huge investment here.
Oh, yeah.
You have to launch a franchise and you have to, there's all this money riding on it. And we paid a lot for these books. We're going to do all these other movies. But going back to Harry Potter is a horcrux. I mean, I think part of his Voldemort got fragmented off when he attacked his parents. And that's what the scar is, that visual indication, I think, of that. And his inability to probably kill himself there because part of the Horcrux is in him after it got split and attached to him. I guess I don't know exactly the mechanics of the Horcruxing, how you Horcrux it up. I did like the explanation later when we got to it in book six with Slughorn, who's also a wonderful character, and you finally get this reveal of Horcruxes and how he explains to, you know, he has that conversation with Tom Riddle where it's, oh, just hypothetical, just in theory, right? We're not going to really do this. And he tells him about it. And you go back and then you see in Chamber of Secrets that he actually did that way back then, probably shortly after I had the conversation with you know, with Slughorn as his professor, and there's the first, you know, creation. I think that's the first Horcrux being created in Chamber of Secrets. It's also the first one being destroyed since it's back when he was a student before he became like a menacing killer. Here's something that's important. The music of John Williams. Yeah.
While we were talking about the Columbus movies real quick, comparatively, I think that the Columbus movies had, to me, they gave me more of the world. They gave me the, like, Hogwarts and the Columbus movies seemed cooler and like more magical.
You can't keep showing the world off to people, even though you have to do a little bit to reestablish.
Yeah.
Like in the seventh film, they're talking about Polyjuice Potion. By then we've seen it many times, but they have to recap it. But when you first experience it in a Columbus film, it's like the whole idea, it's bigger.
It's bigger than what it is, yeah.
But because it's all old hat in a way. So Columbus, he almost had to showcase the world.
He built these amazing
more,
worlds, yeah.
So then we could then just be immersed in it in future films without stopping to take it all in. Although there's still these beautiful moments throughout, but it's less in a grandiose way we're going to show off visual effects or something.
Yeah.
Like especially with the Yates films, the effects are much more organic, and I think Azkaban was really where it started to, like, let's get a more grounded filmic handheld style and let it evolve. But because the Chris Columbus movies are much more classically filmed, even down to classic posters, they have Drew Struzan posters.
Yeah.
You go into John Williams for your music, which is the most Can you think of Star Wars without John Williams? Can you think of Indiana Jones, Jaws, or Jurassic Park?
Sorry, Carl. I've got a John Williams story to tell you that was folks hopefully find interesting, which was when we were shooting Philosopher's Stone, we were quite a way into it. We'd all been on set for a while, and all the young actors were kind of getting comfortable with what they were doing, and everything was constructed, and all the, you know, the big stuff was dealt with. And then one day, one of the ADs came in and sort of with a surprise and gathered everybody together and took us all in a tent, basically sort of said that they had something to show everybody. And what it was the very first reel of Williams music that they'd got for Harry Potter. So nobody'd heard the theme yet, including Chris. So everybody kind of got to hear the music for the very first time all together in a tent. So it was a wild experience because everybody just went crazy. Because you could tell immediately
that's
it was
cool.
One of those themes like Superman or Star Wars. And,
uh-huh. The music changed, you know, everything.
And obviously he's not there throughout. Like Star Wars has John Williams for every film. And they've gone through several composers with Harry Potter. These films are blessed with John Williams music throughout. Obviously, they're films that they use the themes, the key themes, the anchoring. They can go back to what John Williams did. But what do you think these would be like without the magic of John Williams? Obviously, we can talk for days about the influence he had on other franchises.
The only thing I can say is that, you know, over the course of, you know, shooting these things, I think there are a handful of moments that felt like truly magical and like truly kind of special moments where you felt like the whole film unit were really kind of feel like aware of the fact that they were doing something special that was going to last and that would have a cultural impact beyond the books and all that, you know. And I think that John Williams just has, from my point of view, has something unique that brought that on that day. You know, half the cast were crying and, you know, everybody was just so moved by, they could just tell that this was, you know, this was one of those scores that was going to be around for a long, long time, you know. So I think there's something about Williams that I just think he's one of a kind. And although, you know, like, I love all kinds of kind of composers, I think there really is nobody like John Williams, is there? I think he's mm-hmm. unique. I think he's just got that something special, that Star Wars oxygen, you know. He's that guy. He's irreplaceable.
So cool.
Now, Columbus's films, these first two that we're talking about are, I wouldn't say they're widely dismissed, but they're not looked upon as favorably as other installments like Azkaban or some of the later ones. And, you know, they maybe didn't attract the adults like Jimmy. You said, you know, you weren't pulled into it. Mm-hmm. You weren't of the age. Although they're very adored by diehards. Personally, I love them. What I love about Harry Potter movies is I could live in them. I want to eat at the feast. I want to live in.
You want to eat at one of those giant
Sirius Black's.
You want to eat in the cafeteria
apartment.
Tables with all those candles dripping on you from the, like, where
Delicious.
Did all the, who cleaned up all that wax? Like,
it doesn't drip on you.
Like, do you know how many burns
Razzle,
those kids would have?
That is an endless buffet.
Yeah, but those candles are just floating above like dripping wax.
They're not dripping. They're not dripping. And then you get a starscape above your head, and then they're bringing out pumpkin juice, and then you're eating like Yorkshire pudding and prime rib and
do you ever
and all
stop
types of
eating?
Yeah.
So, do you think it's the young leads that hold us back, Georgie? Is that maybe why adults weren't pulled into it because you're looking at these 10-year-old protagonists? Or do you view all the films equally? You know, you're of a generation, you grew up with these. Did you ever feel there was like a ranking to them, or that there was this stigma that, oh, those two Columbus movies?
No, not at all. I mean, I knew which books were my favorite. Like,
which is your favorite
Prisoner
book?
Of Azkaban.
Okay, and you love time travel then? Your big term? No.
And I love Sirius Black.
Oh, he's the coolest. Rousel's favorite, little known fact, is Dobby. His favorite book is
My name's Dobby.
Harry Potter and the Soggy Biscuit. Is
my
Rousel's
name is Dobby.
Book.
Give me some clothes, Harry. My name is Dobby.
Did you cry when Dobby died, Ron?
Dobby is some people would say the Jar Jar of the Harry Potter universe.
Dobby's a little bitch, bro.
I would love to see a buddy cop film with the two of them. And
fuck,
you know,
Dobby,
what?
Dude.
I love Dobby. And I love Jar Jar, too.
Hey, Harry Potter, I'm gonna get you in trouble by
throw him this cake.
I know what I do. I go around.
Bobby was trying to protect him, Razzle. Come on.
You know what I do? I go to my house and I'll just walk by. I'll throw a sock on my dog. I'm like, you're free. I always throw socks on people. I tell them they're free.
Oh my gosh.
I love Dobby. I love, and also,
if I was Harry Potter and Dobby was getting friends, in trouble.
When my niece comes to visit, you know, she just turned like 17, but she was coming for a while. She was younger and she'd stay with us. And I'd be like, you're a house elf now. You have to help us with the chores. You do whatever I tell you. And if you're there, you're my house elf, you know? So it's a cool job.
Then Harry Potter gave him a sock at the end. I would have just been like, yo, Lucius, Dobby was visiting me a couple weeks ago and he was doing some bad things.
Dobby puts that sock on the doorknob. Dobby's
going to the room of whatever that's requirement. Called, requirement, and putting the sock on the door with some other house elves.
I'm going to throw up. I don't want to think about Dobby's
I love pee-pee. Creature. I love house elves. And Dobby is cool. Yeah, Razzle hates Dobby. What about you, Paul or Jimmy? You know, you guys obviously, weren't kids when these came out.
Yeah.
Star Wars was your franchise. But do you think it's because there were child protagonists that pushed you back? It's the same thing with Anakin Skywalker and Jake Lloyd. A lot of people are like, fuck this kid. Mm-hmm. Fuck this stupid mannequin. Mm-hmm. People hated him. And it was because they expected Star Wars to have matured with them. Oh, well, I'm 28 and I want the movie to be R-rated and I want slow motion effects like Matrix. And they put all these expectations on it. And here they're telling a chapter one. And it can't be darker or scarier, just like the prequels couldn't be more intense than Empire Strikes Back. But do you think it's the kid stigma, or what is it that maybe didn't have adults connect with it?
Yeah, ask Jimmy, because Jimmy didn't watch.
Well, I'll tell you,
recently.
Know what the thing is I believe it's because of the fact that the books were published by Scholastic here in the States. And knowing that, having that knowledge, I just immediately wrote off Harry Potter as a kiddie series. I didn't realize it had such a rich mythology to it, and the world building was so enormous, and that it went so dark and could appeal to adults.
So much more.
Yeah. So, I think it's also my sister-in-law was the first person who really got me into it, because I was aware of it. And I was like, oh, this is cool. I want to read it. And she was close to my age, maybe she's a few years older, and it was around the holidays, and she was obsessed with it. She's like, how have you not read this? She like literally threw it at me. She's like, go read this book right now. It's incredible. You're going to flip out. And I was like,
and then he was like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to go clean some house.
And I did. And I was like, you know what? You're right. And shortly later, I was playing like the Harry Potter Uno with the gnomes. And I became a Harry Potter fanatic.
But it is. It's
it did feel like a kid
imprint.
Thing. You're right. Scholastic, young reader.
That's the thing.
Now young reader
up.
Books
I thought it
are
was
all
a story
romantic.
For fourth graders. I really did. Because those were the books I got in the fourth grade. They would come, we would have these book orders at school, and we would get all these Scholastic books. I didn't think that Scholastic could possibly publish something that would appeal to me as a 30-something-year-old adult when the first film came out. So, yeah, that's probably the main thing that kept me away. It wasn't the kid actors. It was just the idea that it was created for children.
This kind of puts a spin on things, because back when the books were first kind of going crazy over here, oddly enough, like as I started to work on the movies, it was actually my mum who was like a super enthusiastic about the books, and she was in her 80s, so she was like, oh, fantastic that you're going to be working on Harry Potter, they're so popular and the good books. And you know, so it just shows you that it still had appeal. But I think my mum quite liked the idea of the way that it just, you know, it made the uncool kids the cool kids, you know, the ginger kid and the kid with the glasses, and, you know, it made them the heroes. So and so I think she quite liked just that idea that it was going to make nice kids, you know,
who
front
published
center
it in the UK? Was it a kids publisher in the UK who put the books out? Did it have that stigma?
You know, I'm not even sure. I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think so, right?
I think it was just, you know, I mean, it was understood it was a kids book, but I mean, it was so widely read. I mean, you couldn't get on a tube station in the early noughties without seeing like an adult reading Harry Potter. So, I mean,
it was an English thing first. It didn't get released at the same time here because they changed the title.
But then, you know,
We have
a long
few months
legacy of like Enid Blyton and, you know, children's books that are still kind of, you know, and the Narnia Chronicles and The Hobbit and things like that. You know, like it's just accepted that these children's books can be entertaining for adults. So I think because of the genre in part, because it's kind of like fantasy and it almost feels like a book that was written in the 40s, You know, like,
yeah, there's something classic about it, which is why I do like the Columbus films. I feel like they paid homage to that, and they referenced it, but they knew that in order for it to grow, they'd have to push beyond it. They'd have to modernize it. Pretty soon you see the kids wearing like All Saints clothes and dressing like they're in Mumford and Sons, and like it becomes very modern. Well,
there was a BBC adaptation of the Narnia books, right, that I always think is a good case in point, in that the children in that were what we call over here BBC children, which are like the kind of kids you don't get in the real world. Now they're all like, "Oh, mother, may I have another tea? Would you pass me a biscuit, please?"
They're largely
in the 1920s, you know, they didn't exist. Only BBC TV programs.
And they're like, in school robes. Mary Poppins. Those little guys. Are you troublemakers?
Or the kids from like The Ring?
Drink your milk?
Yeah. Or the kids from like The Ring or The Shining that would freak you out if you seen them following you.
Yeah, these weren't like the kids in Goonies. You know what I mean? They're not that irreverent.
I am curious, since we were talking about the transition of starting as kids' books and ending in more adult books, with Georgie, since you know, you're fairly younger than us all, and you actually did grow up with the books and the films. What are your thoughts on that as far as like the transition of the books and the films evolving as, you know, as the kids get older and evolving into more adult themed storylines?
I guess I didn't even look at it like that because I was evolving with it. So I just, you know, I watched the first movie and I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then it just started getting darker and darker. But I wasn't really aware of that.
Yeah.
I think just because I was getting older. Maybe reading them, because I read them all. And then as they were coming out, and then as Deathly Hallows was coming out, I reread them up until book 6. And then as I read them all within like a few months, then I realized like, oh, this is getting a lot darker. But yeah, I guess.
Right on.
So here's a question. What school are you in, Georgia?
Yes.
I can't tell you.
You can even pick Durmstrang or Beaubatons or maybe one of these new
school. I'm in Hogwarts.
A Canadian school. It's where everyone's moving to now, the Canadian school.
Well, according to Pottermore, I am a Slytherin, which is BS, but I only took the test once. Well, and every other test I've ever taken, I'm Ravenclaw, and I know I'm a Ravenclaw, so fuck Pottermore.
All I can say is I remember the very first day I spent on set, they had to kind of sort out all the guys that were playing kind of, you know, wizardy teachers into houses. And every single person, they had a debate about it. It was like, Gryffindor, no, Hufflepuff. And they got to me and they just went Slytherin straight away. I was like, hey, hang on.
Oh my, that means you just look like a Slytherin. Well,
yeah, it was like, okay.
Do you have dark hair?
Fine.
I'm Gryffindor. I think because also my wife thinks I have traces of red in my hair, and she likes the Weasleys in there.
You're full Gryffindor.
Yo,
my son. I went to the Warner Brothers.
I am, right?
You're so Hufflepuff.
And that's bullshit. I should be Slytherin. Like,
I went, no.
Like, I'm an asshole. I would be a Sith Lord if I had Jedi powers. Razzle, I should be a Slytherin.
Nice.
You know what? You know what? Or something else? I did the Patronus thing, and I got a fucking Mastiff. Like, what is that? I got a little dog? Come on.
A Mastiff.
I want like a dragon, or I want like a flying deer, or like something that shoots lasers out of its eyes. Maybe a shark with wings.
No,
I want one of those
badger.
Things.
You have a badger.
Badger.
I got a Mastiff.
Or
like,
a
what?
That's funny.
At least you didn't get like a prairie.
No, I got Gryffindor. I actually got Gryffindor.
Like a prairie
according
dog?
To
really? A prairie dog would be
yeah,
amazing.
According to that website, I got Gryffindor. Like, what?
I'm Gryffindor. My son, he was only like 7 months old maybe, and I took him to the Harry Potter Museum at Warner Brothers lot. And you're not supposed to be there unless you're under like over 13. But since I was visiting my wife at work, I snuck him in there, and they were like, "All right." So I stuck him on the chair, and he got sorted. So he was the youngest child ever sorted by their sorting hat, and he got Gryffindor too. So it's like a family thing. I have to take Leo Thames to it to get sorted. Yeah, I don't know. I think Jimmy, what school are you?
Well, you know, when I was younger, I had reddish hair. My son has bright red hair.
That's
so
true.
I think we have some Weasley blood. I believe we would be Gryffindor.
You can't just be Gryffindor just because you're ginger, though.
No, I didn't say
that. Hey, I got red hair on my chin. I'm a ginger. I'm a ginger.
I think you guys are both Hufflepuff. It's not a bad thing.
Hufflepuff. What are you? Nice. What did you say you were?
Ravenclaw.
Ravenclaw. See, that sounds way cooler than Gryffindor.
That's because I'm smart.
Gryffindor's cool. God, I might Gryffindor. Be a muggle. Razzle, I think Razzle would have ended up with like Luna Lovegood, although I would love to see Harry end up with Luna Lovegood.
Who's Luna Lovegood? That Ginny. Albino girl who's like a crazy, like
She's
scary
the
girl?
Coolest character.
That girl who knows, hi, Harry.
Like, if I was setting up for a road trip, me personally, it'd be with Luna.
She's that blonde albino
Dobby.
Chick, right?
Yeah.
She's a girl.
Serious black.
Yo, Luna Lovegood, you'd be married to Luna Lovegood, and then you wake up tired in the nighttime and she just appear in the doorway and freak you out because she's like glows like, hi, I'm a ghost, hi.
Luna's the coolest.
Your Luna voice is the same as your Dobby voice.
That's because they're the same person. Has Luna Lovegood and Dobby ever been in the same room at the same time?
Yes.
What about that girl who lives in the toilet? What's up with that voice?
Moaning Myrtle.
She's actually in the Cursed Child play too. She's she's around. Moaning Myrtle, are you into her, Razzle?
No. She's a ghost.
Maybe when she was not a ghost.
Maybe when she was not a ghost. Hey, man, she's down to... She was kind of getting freaky with Harry.
Time travel back.
How old was Moaning Myrtle when she died?
Wait, I want to ask
like
Paul
she
a
was
question.
Upperclassman? Yeah,
yeah. So Moaning Myrtle was technically probably like 19 or 20, right? Floating around?
Let's say 18.
No, she wasn't. You guys, she was in high school.
Let's say she's 18 and she's trying to see Harry Potter
Paul
naked
about,
in that bath. Like, that's kind of creepy,
Cursed
girl.
Child. Paul, have you seen it since you're over there?
No. No. Not
what?
Paul!
Paul, these are privileges that English people have that Americans do not. Yeah.
Paul! I'm sure you can get free tickets.
Get to it.
It's 20 minutes away from my house too, you know.
Oh my God.
I'm going to come over there soon.
Like, we're like 7 minutes away from Leavesden by car.
I'm going to come over in the spring because Arsenal are doing well in the league. I'm going to go and watch some games and we're going to go see Harry Potter and the
What we should do is
we should
go around the Harry Potter tour and we'll take Athena
Georgie.
Too because we both play teachers and we'll give you the real lowdown rather than what's on the card.
No, yes, I'm coming. Just tell me when and I'll book a flight. I'll be there.
We'll show you all the locations in the city too, because there's a lot of places that we just hang out. Like there's Leadenhall Market is when Harry first leaves with Hagrid to go and, you know, is it Leaky Cauldron, the first pub that he goes in at the very start? When he first goes in that,
like the Star Wars cantina,
right,
you mean?
Place called Leadenhall, which is like a regular haunt for me where I go to drink. So
that's so cool.
And Paul, you took me to the location where Harry Potter is taken into the Ministry of Magic.
That's right.
By Mr. Dursley.
Yeah,
that was
Shankar
tucked
Rose.
Away.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
That was cool.
And the Millennium Bridge as well that gets taken out by the bad guys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another great
Death
sequence.
Eaters.
Yes, that was cool.
We have like there is a kind of like, you know, once you get to know London, it's one of these places where there are streets that are just one thing. So for some reason, it's just the way it kind of ended up. There is a street that's nothing but music shops. You know, there's a street that's nothing but records, nothing but musical instruments, nothing but books, nothing but art. You know, so we do have a tendency to do that. They're all places that are just totally kind of, you know, one thing. So for me, it kind of does feel very London that there's a street for magic, you know? That's not that odd, you know?
And chocolates.
Yeah.
And wands.
Yeah.
And we didn't even get... Look, we got this whole thing. We didn't even talk about Quidditch.
No.
We didn't talk about...
That's what would kill me. If I went to...
We didn't talk about the Golden Snitch.
I'm so rubbish at sport. Swords. I just the first day there.
Boring.
I
what are you guys talking about?
Brain myself.
Boring. No, I let's say who just focusing on these two films, Sorcerer's Stone and Chamber of Secrets. Is there do you have a favorite scene or a favorite actor or character?
It's going to be Snape for me.
Hagrid. Oh, like Snape.
Snape, though, in the beginning. Snape towards the end.
Such a great actor.
Yeah. Oh, I love him so much.
So you like Hagrid. Razzle, you have a favorite?
I would probably say...
Hermione. Razzle likes Hermione.
Can I say I like Hermione now?
Oh, my gosh, Razzle.
Yeah, I don't know. Definitely not Dumbledore. Definitely not MacArthur Park. Fuck that dude. Like, Dumbledore got cool later. He was like this. Like,
you mean after the actor died?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, the only thing he did. Look, dude, yeah, I know Richard Harris. MacArthur Park is a great song, but here's the deal. This is Dumbledore in these two movies. And you said he did, there was a lot of ADR. Why didn't they, like, ADR his voice better? This is, ready? If you think my voice for Dobby and that blonde girl were the same, tell me if Dumbledore's voice sounds any different. Hi, Harry. My name, hi, Harry.
Hey, Harry, I'm a crazy old man, no, Harry.
I want to hear a word of it, because I went with Richard Harris on Gladiator 2.
Dumbledore. Dumbledore sounded like he like one of those cigarette machines, like in the 80s. Yeah, I did not know that.
It's like expecting all of this to be
Richard Harris was one of those chain smokers that has that machine next to their neck, only the battery's dying. The battery's getting low. So it's like,
I did not know they were bad for me. I did not know they were bad for me.
He's a legend.
I prefer Richard Harris to Michael Gambon's Dumbledore. Yeah. There's a warmth that Richard Harris brought and a mystery. And I felt, not that it's one dimensional. You couldn't understand him, though. But there... He's not as nuanced, Michael Gambon's Dumbledore. It got better as it went along, and it's a hard task
Michael
to step
Gambon
in and
was
it'd
the
be like
one,
replace
right?
Obi-Wan Kenobi in Empire Strikes Back. It's a hard thing.
Yeah, Ewan McGregor. There we go.
No, that was a prequel.
Boom.
Which they are casting a young Dumbledore now. They've discussed. So yeah, a favorite character.
Maybe they'll show him lose his voice.
I love Dumbledore. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I do love Dumbledore. It's really hard to pick because it's like picking favorite family
member. Well, just
member.
When you were reading it for the first time, I loved Hagrid. He was so sweet, and he just was protecting Harry, and it was like the first person who understood him.
Harry's and your introduction to the
I don't think I ended up picking one. I just said I didn't like Dumbledore. I'm going to say my favorite character is Lucius Malfoy because he's like a rich dude, and he's like, he dresses cool.
You're
and he's
Slytherin
like,
for
he's,
sure.
He's like,
and
hey.
He looks a lot like Luna Lovegood.
He's got like elfish hair. He's got long. He looks like he should be in the band like Cinderella or something like that. Lucius Malfoy looks like he was in the band Nelson with the Nelson brothers.
I know what how familiar were you with most of these actors? Were they all kind of familiar faces to you?
None of them were.
None
except
of them.
For Gary Oldman. Only Gary Oldman. You
know. Yo, I mean, I knew.
I knew everybody. Alan Rickman. You had what's his name? Kenneth Branagh.
Hans Gruber, baby.
That's talking. But maybe the only I wasn't familiar with the guy who played Quirrell.
Alan Rickman was great.
But Richard Harris, all of these people, the whole movie is like a hoot. It just gets better as it goes along, which we're going to talk about on the next episode, where we're going to get into Azkaban, and we're going to get into Goblet of Fire, and we're going to get into the expanding world. We're going to move beyond the border of Hogwarts into the larger wizarding world. We're going to get into that all on the next episode, and so stay tuned for that, or just keep listening because it's just going to keep flowing in your feed. We've got Harry Potter coming at your ears. Open up your mouth. This is going to taste better than Dumbledore casting a spell right in it. We've got so much Harry Potter coming. Georgie, where can we find you online?
On the internet.
The internet.
What? I'm just kidding. Oh. What do you mean? You have
What's
to tell
your
you
handle, yo?
It's OKGeorgie on Twitter, which I'm not active. OKGeorgie on Instagram.
Which you're very active.
I mean, barely.
You post things.
I post things like once
That's called
a week,
active.
Maybe twice a week. Whatever.
Paul, where can we talk more franchisee stuff with you?
You can find me on Twitter with Paul, at PaulRMQ, as in Ralph McQuarrie.
I'm following you now, Paul.
That's an easy place. Or you can kind of go via Rebel Force Radio and check out Star Wars Influences, where I talk people's ears off about the artwork behind Star Wars.
Paul and Jimmy
co-host
a show on that network where they talk about Star Wars art, influences, production design, everything that's gone into, you know, what's made Star Wars visually Star Wars and thematically story. It's a really in-depth show. It's very wonderful. Jimmy also hosts the Star Wars Rebel Force Radio show. They also analyze episodes of the ongoing Rebels series. And Jimmy co-hosts the Oxygen. We were talking about John Williams' music, and I wanted to bring that before, but it's a really wonderful look at John Williams' music, his influence on the Star Wars franchise. And, you know, maybe in the future, Jimmy's going to do outside of Star Wars John Williams analysis. Maybe it'll include some Harry Potter. Yeah. But that is another wonderful show on their networks. You can find those guys there. Jimmy, what's your handle online?
Well, you know, you can find us at rebelforceradio.com, facebook.com/rebelforceradio, at rebelforceradio on Twitter. And then my personal is at Jimmy Mac Radio on Twitter. And I'm also on Facebook. But, you know, that's all Star Wars stuff. And I don't know. I think after this experience, I might be leaving that all behind, and I'm going to check in a Hogwarts and just I'm going to put my podcast flag there and just spend the next 10 years talking about nothing but Harry Potter. No,
well, you've got five films coming.
There's no way you'll pull me out of Star Wars. Forget about it. I'll be talking the wars until the day I die. But I have to say, you know, this has been my first Harry Potter discussion with anyone in the world ever. And I couldn't think of better people to have this discussion with. So thank you guys so much for not making me feel stupid. and you know, maybe I brought up a few things that maybe that's ground that fans may have gone over a million times before in their past. But this is so new and fresh to me, and I'm feeling pretty excited about it. I'm looking forward to seeing the new film that opens this weekend and taking it from there and seeing where this crazy Harry Potter fandom will take me.
And now you can finally talk to Jason Swank about it too. Your Rebel Force Radio co-host. He's also a fanatic
all the time. And
now you know
he's more into Twilight, though, isn't he, Jimmy?
Yeah, he does like Twilight, and that's kind of a bit.
who is this person?
Razzle. Where can we find you?
You can follow me on Twitter at my name is Razzle. And the number two, you can follow me on Instagram at my name is Razzle. Snapchat at my name is Razzle.
MySpace, my name is Razzle.
MySpace, my name is Razzle. LinkedIn, my name is Razzle. LiveJournal, my name is Razzle.
Facebook, his name is not Razzle. They banned him.
No, I got back. I'm back. I figured it out. Okay. I figured it out. I, you know, maybe forged some documents, but they took care of that. You can also find me on Friendster. If you guys remember what that is.
Bumble.
Yeah, I'm on Bumble. I'm on Tinder. I'm on Raya. Razzle, you know, I'm on all
Razzle
those.
Was my name. Is his friend's new name.
What's his name?
Kyle.
He's on
Kyle.
Grindr.
His name was Jonas. Kyle.
I'm Kyle _ Newman, N-E-W-M-A-N, on Insta and Twitter, on Facebook. You know, if you have thoughts about this stuff, want to get into further chat, you can also find us on the Franchise Pod. POD, right? Is that the handle exactly, Razzle?
Yes,
we're gonna be posting several pictures of Paul sitting next to Quirrell and Snape in the movie.
Yeah.
So go check those out. Paul, those should be your new profile pics.
Yeah.
Paul, you should cosplay as Paul for Halloween.
Yeah, next year Halloween.
Just go as yourself from Harry Potter. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, right. I'll go as an owl.
Hedwig. You know, I'm going to say my favorite character is Hedwig. So much character development. Yep. All right, so with that, we will see you all soon. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Stupefy!
The Franchise is a Howl original and production of Midroll Media. The show is edited and produced by Jimmy Mac McInerney and hosted by Kyle Newman and me, Razzle Dangerously. See you next time.
This is Tony Rodriguez.
This is Carlos Santos.
This is Raiza Licea.
And this is Oscar Montoya.
When our powers combine, we are
Spanish Aquí Presents.
We have a brand new podcast here on Earwolf, bringing you the best of the best of lo mejor of the Latinx comedy.
Join us every Tuesday as we chat about what's going on in our lives, Latinx culture, and qué es lo que?
Lo que no está picando.
Lo que te pica. Don't worry, we'll tell you what that means if you listen.
We'll also be joined by a new guest every single week. We'll get to know a little bit more about their lives.
Every single week.
Uh-huh. And then we'll make them sit back and watch us improvise their lives right back to them.
Improvisation. Spanish Aquí Presents premieres July 16th. Subscribe now in Stitcher,
Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you listen.
O donde sea.
Spanish Aquí Presents.